Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone.
Back on the morning schedule. So you feel properly energized? The weight of the world hasn't crushed your spirit yet? I feel too much has happened by noon and it puts you in a sour mood.
Well, it's like that whole breakfast at Tiffany's thing. I mean, there's something about mornings that are hopeful. And I like a good morning, you know. Yet something great may happen today.
By noon, you know that's not true. I think it's just as crappy
every
as
morning
it always
you,
was.
Every morning you wake, the optimist wakes up thinking it might. So,
I saw a tweet the other day from Benji Sarlin who's an MSNBC reporter. Saying how weird it is for those of us in the 9/11 generation to be witnessing, you know, this Iraq debate all over again. I responded in kind, and just as weird as those of us who grew up on Iraq War I to then see Iraq War II, 13 years later. It made me think, you know, we've basically been dealing with Iraq now for 24 years. ever since Saddam, you know, invaded the border. I think you could probably pin it back to when, you know, George H.W. Bush's ambassador April Glaspie neglected to tell Saddam that it would be a bad idea for you to invade Kuwait. She said your border dispute is not a concern to us. And then she said afterwards, I had no idea it was actually going to invade the place. Don't pin that on me. But it's been a long slog over there, and we're and it seems like the fact that so many of the Bush circle were discredited by their cheery assumptions going in 2003, they're all over the TV again as if nothing happened before. Our conservatives heralding their return to the stage, or like definitely saying, "Hey guys, please go away. Let's have a clean slate here when we have this discussion."
Well, I mean, I have a conflict of interest because, you know, if the more Bill Kristol's on TV, the less I'm probably going to be. So, you know, I mean, I would love for that generation of conservative pundits to be widely discredited, if for no other reason than it opens up spots for those of us who sort of came after. I don't have a lot of thoughts on it. I mean, first, you know, as you know, like everybody was, you know, from Hillary Clinton to Andrew Sullivan to Ezra Klein, there were a lot of people who were for the Iraqi invasion, or who were sort of trumpeting it. Having said that, I think, you know, there are certain people like Bill Kristol and certainly the architects like Wolfowitz and Cheney, who sort of, you know, bear a much larger responsibility for the initial invasion. So I'm sort of with Byron York, who basically said, like, you know, maybe there's something valuable that they learned and that we shouldn't, like, exclude them from being part of this conversation. But it might be nice if they were to acknowledge that they did make some mistakes along the way. And I think you could acknowledge mistakes and still think that the invasion was worth it. But certainly there were mistakes made. And, you know, Megyn Kelly on Fox News brought this up, Wednesday night on Fox, when she challenged Cheney a little bit, some of the things he got wrong. And so that's sort of the middle ground that I would take. I don't think that you need to, like, to say people, you know, no longer should be allowed to talk, but it would be nice if they were to, you know, gain some wisdom and do some introspection and you know, use that as part of their calculation about a very different question now as to what we ought to do now. And I think that, the last thing I would say is I also think that Bush Cheney made mistakes in 2003. I think Obama made mistakes. You know, in terms of not keeping some troops there. And now I think there's this next question, which is what should we do? And that's a much harder thing to talk about. And that's where the Benji Sarlin thing hits home, which is it was very easy to second guess Bush Cheney, what they did in 2003. But now that we must grapple right now with what should we do today, it's a much harder thing when you're actually in the moment and having to, whether you're, you know, someone in power who's actually deciding what to do, or even a pundit saying what should we do? This is where the rubber meets the road.
I mean, I actually want to get to the what should we do now question, because I wrote a piece about that earlier this week. But just to echo and to add what you were saying before, I totally agree that just because a person makes a policy error, that in and of itself should not banish you from all public discourse. Everybody makes mistakes in life, even colossal ones. It doesn't mean that all wisdom you have accrued over time is all negated. But certainly when you're talking about the matter in which you made the mistake, I think if I'm a TV booker or a magazine editor, before I just bring anyone on willy-nilly just because they're available and maybe have self-interest in passing blame off to others, I wanna put them through their paces and say, okay, before they're on the air, hey, you made these mistakes. You said things that were demonstrably untrue, intentionally or unintentionally. Bad things happened as a result. What did you learn from these mistakes? How have your views changed? How has your newfound wisdom apply to the current set of circumstances? If you can't answer that for me intelligently, then you're not contributing to the future discussion. You're just trying to wash away your sins and point the finger at somebody else. That to me is not, maybe it's good for ratings and that you have a,
right, well,
you have a fresh
but that's
argument.
The point. No, but that's the point, Bill. It is. It's not, TV shows do not exist to get to the bottom of problems. I mean, they exist to get ratings, and therein lies the problem. I mean, there's a reason why people like, you know, Frank Luntz and Dick Morris are great pundits talking about campaigns and messaging, because they're never equivocating. They're never, nothing's nuanced. It's always, and by the way, Newt Gingrich is great at this as well. I mean, you know, it's always 100% Mitt Romney will win in a landslide. And that's good TV. And I think that, you know, you could bring me on and have me sort of wrestle with the nuances of this, or not that I'm a foreign policy expert, by the way, but that's what would be happening. Or you could bring on Bill Kristol, who's like 100% sure that Obama's a weakling and that we are signaling weakness around the globe, and that you can see that everywhere from Syria to Crimea to Iraq. And that we simply have to do airstrikes 5 minutes ago, that there's no other alternative. And if we don't, it's the end of society. And that's more compelling television. And so that's why he gets the phone call, I suspect.
Right. And I you know, such is the way of the world. But I think that those of us who aren't in their position, I think, are right to say, Look, Dick Cheney, you're the one who said that the insurgency was in its last throes. You're the one that said we're going to be greeted as liberators. None of those things came to pass. You don't get free reign to say this is all Obama's fault. That just makes no sense. You have to account, being held to account is not just I take responsibility, move along now. It's actually explaining why you got it wrong.
Yeah,
what was wrong about
and,
it?
And how
have your views changed since?
And I would say I think it's entirely possible that that Cheney's right about a lot of things, and I don't think that this discredits his foreign policy worldview necessarily to admit that he got some big things wrong, and I think hurt the cause of the neocons actually by getting those things wrong. But I would also sort of echo what you're saying, and I think that people who, you know, there's been a lot of I'm trying to think of the latest book called The Upside of Down, where, you know, people who fail and make mistakes are actually oftentimes the best prepared. There's this, I'm going to totally paraphrase here, but I saw some sort of a statistic that people who started a successful business and then started a second successful business, I'm sorry, they started a successful business and then started a second business, the second business was less likely to succeed than somebody who had started a failing business and then started a second business. I hope I didn't mangle that. But essentially...
No, I mean, this is why I was not a person saying healthcare.gov doesn't work today. Fire everybody.
Right.
There's a problem in the VA. Fire the guy who's had the most honorable military career, you know, of almost anybody in the country. You know, sometimes when mistakes happen, the people who are around might know how to fix them well. So I don't want to be knee-jerk about it, but if neoconservatism does not want to be discredited going forward, it has to explain why it didn't work out of the box. It has to show that, okay, just because this piece of it didn't work out, here's why the worldview still holds for these other reasons. But if your response is to ignore the giant right. elephant
and
in
I
the
think,
room,
and
that's
and
not
that's
restoring credibility.
I agree with you completely. You have to deal with reality, and you know, when Greeted with Liberators didn't happen, it was really, you know, a lot of the most sort of egregious errors were based on sort of hype, and selling people that this wouldn't be as difficult as it was. So I completely agree with that. Now, having said that, I think you could make an argument that the neocons, and I'm using that term not derisively, just because, you know, those four intervention is longer. I mean, the whole neocon word is radically changed from what it originally meant when it first came into existence. And I'm sort of reluctantly using it, not derisively. But I think you could make a pretty compelling case that if you look at the world today, what is happening, that there is a danger when America sort of steps back and doesn't keep reserve troops in Iraq, that bad things happen, that there is a vacuum that will be filled by bad actors and by, you know, terrorists. And when you look at the geopolitical situation with Putin, that when America doesn't look strong and I mean, I think that they have an argument, and I think their argument looks better today than it did even a year or two ago, based on the world situation. But I think they have to acknowledge, you know, that mistakes were made.
And I think there is there's definitely a place for that debate, and what was it a mistake for the troops to get pulled out? Of course, there's also a secondary argument. Was it our choice? You know, was it that Obama, you know, didn't take the negotiation seriously, or was it that the Iraqi government was really inflexible on the matter? That's sort of a side discussion.
Well, everyone should read the Dexter Filkins New Yorker piece, What We Left Behind in Iraq,
That was a great piece, but there's also a piece by a former Obama, I think, Pentagon official that also laid out how those negotiations went down. And granted, that guy is from the inside. He obviously has an internal bias, but it was a pretty detailed piece. So I would read both of those pieces. I think they both have a lot of important information. And I think it's an important discussion to have because you want to learn why, you know, things went wrong. I do think that it's not terribly relevant to the question, what do you do now? Nor do I think the 2003 debate is relevant to the question, what do you do now?
Yeah, I think it was Jonathan Chait who's making the point that liberals are sort of more interested in casting blame and taking down the Cheneys and the Crystals than they are in answering this question. And I would say that that's probably true of both sides, actually. And I think you're right that, that the real question is, what do we do now?
Well, and this liberal is not doing that. I had a piece in the week.com earlier, which said, you know, Iraq was not a threat to us in 2013, but now it is. I mean, this, you know, there is, I think, a, you know, there's a bit of an isolationist view, and I'm not trying to use that term pejoratively. I mean, it's a view that if we get involved abroad, bad things happen. You know, backlashes happen.
Right.
We're clumsy. We're overly aggressive. The local populace chafes at our big footing. It brings about all this specter of imperialism. And so it always does more harm than good. We're just better off staying out.
And then, of course, the opposite point would be, when we don't get involved in the world, bad things happen.
Sure.
You're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And, you know, Reagan mostly found that middle ground of sort of supporting indigenous actors. But, you know, that's that doesn't always work either, right?
I don't hold the isolationist view for that reason. But I understand if that is your fundamental view,
why
would not change? I'm sorry, go on.
Well, I was just, you know, the reason a lot of them hate the term isolationist, besides the fact that it was sort of discredited after World War II, is they argued that they're really in favor of, you know, free trade and you know,
that's ridiculous.
I'm just telling you what they said.
The word isolationist is about principles of military intervention. It's not about whether we're going to be economically integrated to the world or not.
They're saying that they're not protectionist in, you know, in terms of tariffs.
Fine, you're not protectionist. I agree that you're not protectionist. Congratulations. But you know, look, I think a pacifist is an honorable thing. You know, if you believe fundamentally that any exercise of military power always is more negative than positive, you know, that's a legitimate view. I don't agree with it, but you know, but that's the view, and there's no shame in that. So all I'm trying to say is that if that was your view before, nothing that transpired this week would alter that view. This would seem to suggest that, you know, the initial invasion in 2003 cracked open all these sectarian differences and therefore we shouldn't have done it in the first place. I have a different view, which I think other liberals share. I don't think I'm unique in this. I think this is a general split on the left, that there is a place for American military intervention in certain circumstances. One of those circumstances is to deal with a global terrorist threat that has some indirect or direct implication to America, and if not just global stability in general. And you know, there was an argument in 2003 that we should not go into Iraq because it distracts from the fight against al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. It saps resources away. It's a totally wrong target. Saddam has nothing to do with this. Focus on al-Qaeda. Well, ISIS is an outgrowth of al-Qaeda. I mean, there's just no getting around that. I think there is a bit of a nuanced point to make that, you know, it's not al-Qaeda in Pakistan. It's an offshoot. They're actually sort of competitors with the Pakistan al-Qaeda. But they have engaged in terrorist acts. They do have cross-border aspirations. And even if, you know, like the Taliban Afghanistan, if sort of their goals are more local than global, as we learned with the Taliban, that can become a breeding ground for other terrorist groups that have more international ambitions, especially attacking us. So I don't think it's something that you get to be sanguine about. I think acknowledging that does not mean you want to do 2003 all over again. There's lots of ways through military intervention that's not Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld style. You know, we would most likely in this case not be doing a ground invasion, not be doing a military occupation, not working. We were working with an elected Iraqi government. We'd be probably working with allies in the region, maybe even non-allies like Iran, and may well be working with the UN too. So there's all sorts of ways this can be handled differently. Plus, there'd probably be a very robust diplomatic component, which we have to acknowledge, you know, by 2007 and the surge that even the Bush folks got. When they did the surge in 2007, it wasn't military only. There was a diplomatic surge that was alongside it that was very critical to its effectiveness. And all and Obama's been very clear that there is no military solution without a political solution. We do have to find a way to integrate the Sunnis better in the government. And they're leaning very hard on Maliki to do a better job or get out if he can't actually govern the whole of Iraq and not lead it into sectarian civil war.
And I think you just hit on the key problem that I have with this, and General Petraeus as well has with this, which is that, you know, the initial invasion was for regime change. Saddam was Sunni, and that had implications, but it was regime change to topple a dictator. Right now, it's very clearly a sectarian split. And if we were to go in, it would very, very well may seem that we are siding with Shia against Sunni. And in fact, we would be. And that brings
I think that's a danger. But this is why the diplomatic piece of it would probably be very critical. If you're going in against ISIS, you better do something alongside it that says, we also want to see Sunnis properly represented in this government, unlike what Maliki has been doing so far, where this is not about trying to crush the Sunnis writ large. It's about trying to isolate these extremists
right.
and making sure are in the government.
And Bill, you tell me, doesn't this go back to when Hussein was toppled initially? We basically got rid of all of his loyalists. And, you know, it's a Shia majority. So didn't the mishandling back, you know, going back to 2003, 2004, almost guarantee that Maliki would set up a Shia government and that Sunni would be essentially outside of the political power? I mean, weren't the seeds of this planted then? And the other point I'll bring up, which is worth mentioning, is the notion that Biden and Sam Brownback had of actually creating three, you know, countries, including a Kurd area, which at the time, I think everyone except for Biden and Sam Brownback, as I recall, thought was a really super bad idea. But now maybe people are a little bit less, critical of that idea.
Well, 2 points about those two things. One, if I was a neocon, trying to defend the original invasion, the fact that they chose to disband the Iraq army to have the whole debathification, that was a clear misjudgment. Because, as you said, it did sow the seeds and made it seem like, you know, we're just trying to side with one faction over another. So if I'm a neocon, that's what I would acknowledge. I mean, Paul Bremer, who was the guy who disbanded the Iraqi army, he's out there.
And by the way,
Obama,
he's out there now talking, right?
Right. And he's not acknowledging his own errors. That's the perfect place to say, you know what? The general idea that we should be, siding with democracy over dictatorship was correct. And I have no apologies for getting rid of a murderous dictator like Saddam Hussein. But we have to learn the lesson from the mistakes you made in the execution. If you're going to take that step, you can't also disempower all of that person's allies, thinking that they would help with a clean slate, because in fact, the potential for backlash is very high, and the potential for creating this condition for civil war is very high. If we could do it over again, I would have still invaded, but I would not have done these steps.
That would be, if nothing else, that would be much more interesting to listen to.
So now we do have to. So the fact that they made a mistake, I on the left might want to crow and say, ha ha, you made a mistake. But if I'm in a policymaking position, I have to say, okay, how do I deal with the fact that this mistake was made and rectify it so we don't continue to have ongoing sectarian strife? We need, if Maliki, and this is not a regime change point, by the way, because, the Iraqi government is such that, a parliament is elected and then the factions negotiate, who is the prime minister. And they're actually in the middle of that negotiation right now. So if they choose not to have Maliki, it's not that America ousted an elected chief executive. It's that the parliament chose to go in a different direction following the outcome of the most recent elections based on the performance of the past prime minister. I think we need to be careful how much it's seen as America dictating that choice. So it's accepted on the ground by regular Iraqis. But this is the prime opportunity to say, look, if this guy isn't doing the job of integrating the country, someone else has to do it based on the decisions by the Iraqi people's elected representatives. And to your other point, what was your other point? I had a tip of my tongue. The Biden partition, even the Biden folks would say, that proposal got oversimplified as a hard partition. They weren't literally saying three separate countries. They're talking about more of semi-autonomous states within a larger country. And that argument, I think, does hold more credibility right now. If the Sunnis need that level of autonomy so they don't embrace an ISIS, that should be considered. But that has to be a decision that Iraqis make for themselves, perhaps with our input, perhaps with this. And if we're being asked by the Iraqi government to supply military power, we should well have some input in exchange. But we can't bigfoot it, because if the Iraqi people don't buy into it, then it's not going to work.
Yeah. Well, I guess my final thought on this topic would just be that I'm sad that we're talking about this again. I think that had we handled the last couple of years differently, we may not be talking about this again. And when you take this and combine it with all the other things happening internationally, it's a lot to deal with, a lot of problems out there.
Well, I still have pretty significant hope. I obviously it looks like world falling apart, everything spinning off the wheels, yada yada. You still have this track of Iran diplomacy that's in pretty decent shape. I mean, it's not on a glide path. They are still having a pretty big dispute over how many centrifuges the Iran nuclear program can have, and they haven't solved that yet. But the talks proceed pretty quietly, pretty amicably. There's not a lot of saber rattling on both sides. There's even some discussion that what's going on in Iraq might actually facilitate those talks, because the Iranian interests and the American interests are converging more. And I think this scares neocons. So they think that being closer to Iran might have negative consequences. But the Obama foreign policy vision always was to try to have a game changer in this region, so these long festering disputes can be diffused. The neocons shouldn't be upset about this, because again, they're the ones that sought to empower the Shia more in Iraq than they had been before. Well, there's no way you do that without also empowering Iran at the same time. So if you're going to empower Iran at the same time, you might as well have them be friendlier than they are today.
As we've sort of alluded this whole time, I would be very interested in someone writing. You've got people like Andrew Sullivan who've completely flipped and just recant, and that's not interesting to me anymore. But what I would love to hear is someone like a Bremer who would be honest and say, I still think we did the right thing. Here are all the mistakes we made. That would be a great read if someone actually, maybe someone has done it and I'm not aware of it, But I would be very interested in that, because I think that would be something maybe we actually could learn from.
Well, I mean, I think we have folks like Andrew Sullivan and Peter Beinart that acknowledge their errors and just completely transform their entire foreign policy view.
Right.
So long as that's honest, that's perfectly fine. But, you know, what I think you and I are suggesting on, can you still be a neocon having acknowledged these past mistakes? Can you have a neocon 2.0 that just says, okay, we made mistakes in these particular areas, but the whole worldview does not shot to hell?
And I would argue that you certainly can, and if anything, the events of the last year, again, would make an argument that the opposite of neocon, you know, is also fraught with danger. This is, you know, I feel like, you know, we go back and forth. There's this pendulum between, like, you know, involvement in the world is necessary. America has to be a shining, you know, a beacon on a hill, and we have to be involved, because if we're not, who's going to be? And then the things will inevitably go wrong, because they always do. And then the other extreme would be, you know, we only mess things up when we get involved. We're better off doing some nation building at home. And meanwhile, the world burns and goes to hell without us there. And so, so I think we're now at that end of the of the pendulum swing, where the neocon worldview, I think, is maybe a little more welcome now than it was a year ago. But it would be interesting to hear, but here's where we went wrong. That would be interesting.
Why don't we shift to domestic politics? Do you want to talk about the latest from Brian Schweitzer, or the House leadership races, or the Mississippi primary that's coming up? There's a whole bunch of stuff out there that's intriguing.
Yeah, let's do a quick rundown of what I'm sort of paying attention to. One majority leader race, you've got Raul Labrador, who's running, which seems to be a quixotic campaign against Kevin McCarthy.
That vote's going to happen before this gets posted, I guess, right? That vote's supposed to be today on Thursday?
I think so. So by the time this is posted, that may be somewhat of a moot point. There's also the whip race, which it seems like a guy named Scalise, who is sort of a compromise. Compromise is the wrong word, but acceptable by most conservatives and the establishment. So that's probably how it looks like. That's how it may shake out. And then there's word that John Boehner is much more likely to stay on as speaker and to stay in office as a result of Eric Cantor's loss. So stunning loss, still, you know, reverberating.
But it seems like, despite this Labrador challenge, which most people think is not going to get very far, that McCarthy has a locked up, who's more of a GOP establishment choice. I don't know if it's going to be Scalise or who's sort of a common ground choice within the party's factions, or will it be, you know, Peter Roxham, I think, is considered a bit more establishment. It seems like blood is not on the floor within the House caucus right now, despite the Cantor defeat. But on the other hand, you have this very contentious primary race happening in Mississippi, which I think, unlike the Cantor Brat race, which feels like barely a dime's worth of difference between these people if you really scratch the surface, you have this sort of fundamental debate in Mississippi where Thad Cochran, the incumbent, is saying, it is a good thing that I, as a senator, represented our interests and found federal money to fund local infrastructure projects at home. And the Tea Party candidate McDaniel saying, that's why the system is rotten. We can't have senators actually trying to bring federal money home. We should reject federal money and do things on our own. That's a pretty significant, you know, difference in worldview.
Right. And that's why the Chamber of Commerce is involved, and that's why the Club for Growth is on the other side. I mean, that pits a fundamental split in the Republican Party very well. I mean, that's, you know, the Club for Growth being on the McDaniel side, and the Chamber of Commerce being on the Cochran side. And by the way, the Chamber latest ad that they have is Brett Favre, who lives in Hattiesburg, I think, Mississippi, unless I'm mistaken, doing an ad for Thad Cochran, which some people have pointed out is ironic, because Brett Favre was also a guy who probably hung around a couple seasons longer than he should have when he should have retired. So that's the latest. But yeah, this race is very interesting because you do have that sharp dichotomy between the kind of establishment Republican guy that's, you know, we're going to be Republican, but we're also going to bring home the bacon, versus the sort of free market conservative wing. Now we're seeing this also. We're seeing this also play out in Arkansas, except there's not a primary. But you've got Tom Cotton, who is representing the Club for Growth free market sort of wing, and potentially hurting him in the general election because of things like the Farm Bill, which are popular in Arkansas. So this is this is actually a substantive discussion debate that's actually taking place.
Does it strike you as being potentially damaging if a senator can no longer do his or her job by ensuring that local infrastructure gets funded? I mean, infrastructure traditionally has not been a matter of partisan difference. There are certain things that government just does. Government builds roads. Government builds sewer systems. We don't privatize those things. If Thad Cochran is doing his due diligence to make sure the federal government doesn't neglect his state, Mississippi gets more back from the federal government than they put in taxes. And have the Tea Party then take that and treat that as Exhibit A of overspending, as if that kind of spending is more than a drop in the bucket of the broader federal budget. Does that not distort distort the whole spending debate? Distort what conservatism should be about? It would seem to offer a very radical notion of what of government should be, and won't the voters of Mississippi be the ones getting the short stick at the end of the day? All of a sudden, their projects dry up because they literally have a senator there who doesn't lift a finger to help with their projects. It would seem at best be a Pyrrhic victory. That guy would be tossed out in a few years, and people realize, wait a second, all of a sudden our roads suck. That's no good.
Well, I'm not sure that Mississippi's roads are that great as we speak.
They can always be worse.
Look, I went to college in West Virginia, and there's a state, for example, where I believe there's a Coast Guard base in West Virginia, which is, of course, a landlocked state. But Robert C. Byrd was there bringing back the pork. And I went to college at it's now Shepherd University, and I haven't been back in a year, but I think there's now a Robert Byrd statue. There's like a Robert Byrd library building. These guys who brought back all the bacon, their states didn't get ahead. You know, that is an interesting point, that people like Robert C. Byrd, their state kept electing these guys because they would bring home the bacon, and the states kept falling behind and getting poorer and poorer, and the roads are not that great. So, for what it's worth, look, I think that there are legitimate things that a government ought to be doing, and infrastructure is one of them. Having safe bridges and roads is good for the economy. Obviously, it's a public safety issue as well, and that's very important. I think there is a question of, you know, at what level should federal funds be involved in these things versus, you know, should your local taxes be paying for them? But I also think there's a sense that, things like earmarks and the sort of horse trading that happens where, sort of the cronyism that was involved in getting, you know, I'll support this project if you'll, I mean, you know, on one hand, that worked, right? That got legislation passed and sometimes would help prevent things such as a government shutdown. On the other hand, I think that like it's understandable that the public got fed up with that sort of you know, cronyism and kind of, you know, borderline corruption. So, you know, I think that you could go too far with this, but overall, I mean, I'm kind of in, I think, you know, philosophically speaking, I'm probably closer to the McDaniel camp on this than the Cochran camp.
Now, so that race comes to a head on Tuesday. There's another primary race on Tuesday that's gotten less attention.
Yeah.
I don't know much about it. It's in Oklahoma. What should folks know in advance of that race?
The Oklahoma race, I think, is utterly fascinating. You have two people running. I mean, there are more than two people running, which is why it may go to a runoff, which may not be decided until August. But the two, like, you know, heavyweight contenders are a guy named T.W. Shannon, who was the Speaker of the Oklahoma House of Representatives. He's backed by people like Sarah Palin, the Senate Conservatives Fund, Ted Cruz, also J.C. Watts. So he's half African-American, half Native American. So he basically, for all practical purposes, is the conservative Tea Party guy. He's also, it's an open seat to fill Senator Tom Coburn's seat. Also running is a guy named Representative James Lankford, who is, you know, they're attempting to cast him as the establishment guy, but he has the benefit of having been basically having run for many years a Christian summer camp in Oklahoma where tens of thousands of Oklahomans went through this summer camp. And, you know, apparently there are just these legions of loyalists who turn out to vote for him, who don't necessarily even vote in any other elections that he has up his sleeve. Lankford appears to have more money. Lankford appears to probably have the superior organization. But Shannon is the sort of, you know, Cruz, Palin, Tea Party guy. And so it's going to be very interesting to watch what happens. I think it reminds me a little bit of the Nebraska race, where, remember in Nebraska, you had a guy named Ben Sasse, who was really kind of an establishment guy, but he became the Tea Party guy, even though he's like friends with Karl Rove and like was a university president. He became the Tea Party guy. And this other guy named Shane Osborne, who was fairly conservative, who became, you know, cast as the establishment hack. Well, I think a similar thing is sort of happening where T.W. Shannon, the Speaker of the House of Oklahoma, became the outsider, and this guy James Lankford became the establishment Washington, D.C. guy, when in fact he's probably fairly conservative. So my guess is whoever wins will be acceptable to the other, you know, I hope this will be like Nebraska, where whoever wins, they kiss and make up. Not that it's going to matter in Oklahoma anyway. It's going to be a Republican seat. But I do think that if Republicans want to take the Senate, it's going to be tough enough without having any sort of lingering resentment or bitterness that would hold over long after, especially if this thing goes into August. So that's certainly one to watch. I don't think it's gotten nearly as much attention as it deserves. And if I had to bet who will come out ahead, at this point, it looks like James Lankford.
Very interesting. Now, there's also some activity happening on the Democratic side presidentially, in that you have we talked a little about Brian Schweitzer last week. He gave another profile to the National Journal this week where he made some eyebrow-raising comments saying that Eric Cantor was effeminate
he said that there's this thing that some Southerners have, and he said that he has gaydar that's 60 to 70% accurate, and that if he saw Eric Cantor on TV, without knowing anything else, he would assume he was gay. So, there's that.
Yeah, that's probably not the best way to run in a Democratic primary.
This is from Maren Kogan, who's great, by the way. She does great stuff, her piece.
And yeah, when I read stuff like that, and I took a swipe at Schweitzer before, saying he had a bizarre approach to this whole potential primary challenge, and maybe he just wants to, let us.
He was at the Romney meeting, right?
Well, that's the other weird thing that he did. He speaks at the Mitt Romney. For those who weren't following, he has these annual summits where he brings together his donor circle. And big name Republican politicians and strategists, and have a big confab over where the party should go. And I still understand why Schweitzer went and spoke. And did Romney send an invite? Did he approach Romney? I'm not clear about that. But he gave a talk there, and I don't think he said things that were any different than his usual mix of policy positions. But he had nice words for Romney as a person, which a little weird to do, again, in the context of, he's calling Obama a corporatist and hammering Hillary for being close to Wall Street, yet Romney is peaches. That doesn't quite add up, for a Democratic primary. So I get the sense that he's really running more for talk show host than for anything else. That seems to be, and even talks about that National Journal piece, how he has his whole, he brings the satellite trucks up to his remote Montana ranch and does all his MSNBC appearances from there, because he already has a contributor contract. But it sounds like he's trying to step up the ladder and get his own show, if you ask me. Whereas also in the National Journal, you have this big profile on Bernie Sanders, who gets a little less coverage because he's not as flamboyant as Schweitzer is, but he is saying pretty openly, in fact, he says in the National Journal, I'm looking forward to running for president. So he's clearly serious about it. It's not clear if you do it in a primary or as a third-party candidate, but he has a fairly complete ideological critique of the current system that he's honed for decades, and he's testing out on the stump. He's not just tossing off cheeky soundbites to reporters. He's giving long policy addresses to the faithful, and trying to build a bottom up movement the way he did in Vermont and became pretty untouchable politically in Vermont. And he doesn't take pot shots at Hillary, so he doesn't personalize it. He's making his own critique about the American political system, about party politics in general, and I don't necessarily think he would win against Hillary, but I think he would force a more substantive debate with Hillary about the direction of the party that would be worth having. Whoever was the winner at the end, be putting some real issues on the table and that would have value as far as shaping the entire 2016 discussion. So, if Hillary is just kind of waltzing along and everyone on the Republican Party is being pulled to the right, that has some risk of maybe pulling Hillary to the right in the process, because there's no other center of gravity putting other issues on the table between, December 2015 and June 2016. So I think Sanders is a more relevant person to watch in this discussion than Schweitzer is.
It will be interesting, and I do think that Hillary's not gonna. It's not gonna be unopposed. There's too much reason for somebody to run against her, whether they think they can win or not. So good for them. It's gonna be good for us too to cover. You want to close it up, or you want to talk Redskins?
I'm not as focused on the Redskins as you are. I'm not a fan of the name. I feel its end will come eventually. I love the idea of Washington Department of Football. That tells me is a much better name for a team.
Well, the Washington Reagans has been bandied about of late, and I would approve of that.
You guys want to just slap Reagan on anything? Government buildings.
There's a Reagan building. There's a Reagan airport. Why not a Reagan football team? Let's go out there and win one for the Gipper.
That would be closer to Reagan's spirit than a giant government building. I will not rest
until we are on a Ronald Reagan blogging hits TV show, wearing my Ronald Reagan polo shirt, looking at my Ronald Reagan laptop. Then I will rest.
So now the federal government is wagging its finger at the Redskins, saying you don't have patent trademark protection anymore for the name. If you want to go sell Redskins shirts on the street, you can do that.
We could just call this show the Washington Redskins, and who's stopping us now? Look, if I were going to name a team today, I wouldn't name them the Washington Redskins. But this is my team. This is a team I grew up with. This is a team with Doug Weah. And I think they were the last team to integrate, but they were the first team to have an African-American quarterback named Doug Williams win a Super Bowl. And this is a team that I grew up with, Theismann and the leg thing happening, John Riggins running. You go down the list. Mark Rippon, Jay Schrader. I mean, this is Art Monk. This is a very storied franchise during my childhood, the Joe Gibbs era. I think they won 3 Super Bowls, went to 4. If Riggins hadn't been out partying, they might have won 4. So there's a lot of tradition, and to change the name is a big, big deal at this point. I wouldn't name the team that today. And I've said, if they have to change it, my vote would actually, if they don't go with the Reagans, I would say you have to go with the Washington Hogs. And I would like to see a really tough-looking boar, you know, with like a feather sort of hanging down to pay homage to the old name. And of course, Hogs harkens back to the Gibbs era, the Hogs, you know, the line, the Russ Grimm, those guys who got dirty and messy, and the snouts that people would show up at RFK Stadium and wear with their headdresses. I'm not a fan of changing the name at this point. I wouldn't name them that if we were starting over. But I'm with Sally Jenkins, the Washington Post columnist, the great Sally Jenkins, who argues that if they change, they ought to do it on their own and not have the federal government sort of, you know, I just don't like this, the way that the Patent and Trademark Office is. You know, we know what they're doing. This isn't like a coincidence. This is a sort of a political thing. I don't like their methodology for trying to bring about this change. The heavy hand of government.
I don't know enough about patent and trademark law to know what precedents there are for saying this is a derogatory reference, therefore you can't trademark it. Are there other examples of trademarks that have been denied on those grounds? I thought it was interesting to learn that the board actually made the same decision 20 years ago, but it was overturned in federal courts. And I don't know what the legal reasoning was on either side.
They didn't have standing. The people who brought the case, I don't know why they didn't have standing. Because I think they were Native Americans, but that was, I think that's what it was. But look, what are we going to do about the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame? Because all it takes is an Irishman bringing a suit, apparently. That's a stereotype, man. There's a picture of that guy with his...
It's not the greatest name, I gotta say.
Reinforcing stereotype that Irishmen are a bunch of drunk brawlers who
it kind of is
a drop of a hat. It's offensive.
But yeah, I'm not Irish, so I'm not the one complaining about it, but you could make the case. But clearly I think it's very obvious that the vast majority of Native Americans are not happy with the name. And it's just a name. I mean, if you're making people angry, if it's hurting your brand, I mean, how many people are buying Redskins gear outside the Washington, D.C. area? Because how ridiculous would you look with it? They might be able to get a whole lot more merchandise sales if they had a cooler name and a cooler logo that didn't seem like such a racist throwback.
There's also, here's something that's never just seems like up, by the way. I just thought of it. I don't think anyone's ever brought it up. But the rivalry between the Cowboys and the Redskins, that's sort of, I mean, partly premised on cowboys and Indians fighting to a certain degree. I mean, obviously the fact that they're both...
They can have a go rivalry with the Chiefs.
What's that?
Have a rivalry with the Chiefs. Cars of the Tomahawks, yeah. Or something. You know, I mean, there's all sorts... There's other names that harken back
there's
to
also the Redskin
that
potato idea.
They're not literally a
there's
racial
the Redskins
slur.
Potato idea. There's the Skins, just simply calling them the Skins, which is already their nickname. I mean, there are ideas. Right. But look, here's the other thing. If you are a sort of average guy where I'm from, Wolfsville, Maryland. Oh, my light went out. That means we talked too long, Bill. I got this thing on a timer. No, but if you're just sort of a regular guy and you're looking at all the changes that are happening in the world, and the one thing you've got is your football team, and now they're telling you that your football team is offensive, and that the team you've been rooting for since the Joe Gibbs era, they have to change their name too. I mean, where does this stuff end? Where does the political correctness? Where does it end?
To repurpose a Matt Lewis quote, you know, there's more to life than politics, and there's more to life than a football team's name. You know, this is a clear case of get over it.
I'm reminded of the great
stop having a racist
liberty
name.
I'm reminded of the great George Carlin skit where he says, "I think spokesman ought to be spokespersons, but they want to take it too far. They want me to call that thing in the street a person hole cover." That's the kind of thing you would hear on Late Night with David Letterperson. And so, you know, I mean, like, where does it end? You know, and the you know, what about the Cleveland Indians and their hat, the chief, whatever his name is?
That's
way worse than the Redskins.
It's an awful, Do they still sell that, or have they backed away from?
I don't know, Chief Wahoo, the tribe. I don't know. They got the I think the Fighting Sioux in North Dakota. I think they had to, which I think is arguably an honorable name, the Fighting Sioux. I think that they had to change last I checked. Anyway, it's, you know, some people, again, if I were starting a team today, would I call them the Washington Redskins? No, that would not be at the top of my list. It would be the Washington Reagans. But because...
You're a traditionalist.
Right, we've gotten along pretty well for the last 50 years or however long, you know, this team's been a franchise. Who even knows? I mean, like Sonny Jurgensen's, you know, as far back as I can go, or George Allen. So, but whenever the team started, it came from Boston, maybe. I don't know. Whatever. I do know the Orioles came in existence in 1954. But, you know, for my whole life, it's been the Redskins. And I'm proud of Joe Gibbs and Doug Williams. And you know, I don't want their name, the team that I grew up with and that Joe Gibbs and Doug Williams and John Riggins played for to be like the Clippers or something, you know, the Washington Clippers, the Penguins.
I was really mad when George Steinbrenner leveled Yankee Stadium, the stadium I went to as a kid, to build a big new stadium with a bunch of luxury skyboxes. And I still think, you know, it's
How many World Series, you know, how many World Series the since they built that new stadium? I think so.
None, right?
They should look. You don't mess with a winning streak, Bill. Maybe that's an argument for the Redskins to change their name.
You know, they did it because it made them more money.
Yes.
And Yankees fans are still Yankees fans. And I imagine if the Washington decided to change its name and they would make more money, those fans would still be fans. And everyone would go along with their debt.
The fundamental point, though, that Sally Jenkins was making is she thinks they should change their name, but that the government shouldn't be using, you know, their power to sort of push them to do it. And I think that's a legitimate middle ground to take.
I don't have a strong opinion about it, and just not knowing the history of the law in this area, but I imagine at the end of the day, they're going to do it because of public pressure in general. It's not because of the law. It seems like this kind of thing gets overturned in the courts. I mean, it's going to depend on what judge they get, I imagine. So it doesn't have to be done that way. And I imagine it's going to be done because the public is essentially demanding it.
Well, my theory is that the progressives, the liberals, always win because they never stop agitating. Because if you complain about something for enough time, eventually people will give up and be like, oh, screw it. Change the damn name.
That's what we say. Conservatives and abortion. You guys lost in the Supreme Court for 30 years ago. You still don't give up.
Well, but we're right on that issue.
You're tenacious.
Hey, come on. That's the difference. Come on, you can't see that? we've talked for an hour, so.
All right. Let's leave it there. Always
good
to talk to you,
talking to you, another award-winning show. And I think you could see the energy level in the morning a little bit higher, a little bit better. So good stuff.
All right, till next week.
See you later.